Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that piece was called Prayer. And it's from the group Hun Her Tu. And they are going to be there in town tonight at the Great American Music Hall. And they're touring their latest compilation, Ancestors Call. And we're hoping to have one of the members of the ensemble on the air this morning. And in the meantime, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this ensemble. This particular group is I remember seeing them for the first time. They do what's called throat singing. And the whistling of the high mountain wind creates eerie overtones in postmodern statement. The repeated thrum of a string against wood and hide turns into a meditative, evocative figure straight from the avant-garde. The descendants of isolated Siberian herdsmen make serious strains of the universal music out of some of the planet's quirkiest acoustics. The Tuvan acoustic quartet, Hun Her Tu, proved that Tuvan music can take plenty of intelligent innovation. Using traditional instruments and drawing subtly on 20th century composers, funky rhythms, and the palette of electronica, Hun Her Tu transformed ancient songs into complex acoustic compositions. Let me see if our guest is in the studio. Nope, not yet. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play another one of their pieces. It's called Ancestors, and it's also from that CD I was telling you about.
Thank you.
Well, that was Hun Her Too, and that piece was one of my favorites on this compilation CD, Ancestors. And I don't know what happened. Our guest is not in the studio. I don't know. There must have been some kind of snafu. Yeah, the group's been touring the West 70 years ago, and I remember the first time I saw Tuvan Throat Singers was as a part of the Sacred Concerts series at San Francisco Jazz, and that was, it was just phenomenal. James Carter was on solo sax, tenor sax, and you know that was like, it was just so wonderful. This ensemble is, it comes from the high pastures of the Altai Mountains in south central Siberia. And the musicians have spent decades honing the overtone singing instrumental approaches and their vibrant songs at their home. Yet the group also has a musical savvy and the chops to take their traditions far from the slopes and valleys of Central Asia. And so they've, you know, got fans all over the place. They spark a boom in Tuvan and other throat singing, lute strumming ensembles from Central Asia that have been mainstays of the global music festivals. And, yeah, the most recent member to join the group is the person that I was supposed to be speaking to, Radic, and I don't know how to pronounce Radic's last name, Tuyul Yush, a third-generation throat singer and a talented multi-instrumentalist and conservatory-trained composer. And he's added a dose of youthful energy and rhythmic complexity, recalling good old American funk, and that was going to be really fantastic talking to him. And, yeah, but maybe some other time. So we are going to go into the archives and I want to play something, play a little bit of Jacqueline. Actually, I'd rather play more of Jacqueline Stewart. let's see. I'm not sure what I want to play because I am kind of, I don't have a lot of time because we have these great guests coming in from the Third Eye Asian American Film Festival, San Francisco International South Asian American Film Festival, and we're going to be talking to a wonderful director, oh my goodness, Amit Ashraf. His film Runaway is, oh, it's riveting. And, yeah, really, really looking forward to that conversation. So, I think I'll just, I'll play James Baldwin. I just keep on looking at this. I say, James Baldwin, Take This Hammer, Part 1. I think we'll play that. Actually, maybe James Baldwin, The Artist's Struggle for Integrity. I think we'll play that one.
It seems to me that the artist's struggle for his integrity is a kind of metaphor, must be considered as a metaphor for the struggle which is universal and daily of all human beings on the face of this terrifying globe to get to become human beings. It is not your fault, and it is not my fault that I write. I would never come before you in the position of a complainant for doing something that I must do. What we might get at this evening, if we are lucky, if the mic doesn't fail, my voice holds out, if you ask me questions, is what the importance of this effort is. It would seem to me that, however arrogant this may sound, I want to suggest two propositions. The first one is that the poets, by which I mean all artists, are finally the only people who know the truth about us. Soldiers don't, statesmen don't, priests don't, union leaders don't. Only the poets. That's my first proposition. The second proposition is what I really want to get at tonight. And it sounds mystical, I think, in a country like ours and at a time like this. But something awful is happening to a civilization when it ceases to produce poets, and what is even more crucial, when it ceases anywhere but ever to believe in the report that only poets can make. People, millions of people, whom you will never see, who don't know you, never will know you, people who may try to kill you in the morning, live in a darkness which, if you have that funny, terrible thing which every artist can recognize and no artist can define, you are responsible to those people to lighten that darkness, and it does not matter what happens to you. You are being used in the way a crab is useful, the way sand certainly has some function. It is impersonal. This force which you didn't ask for, and this destiny which you must accept, is also your responsibility. And if you survive it, if you don't cheat, if you don't lie, it is not only, you know, your glory, your achievement. It is almost our only hope. Because only an artist can tell, and only artists have told, since we have heard of man, what it is like for anyone who gets this planet to survive it. What it is like to die, or to have somebody die. What it is like to fear death. What it is like to fear. What it is like to love. What it is like to be glad. Hymns don't do this. Churches really cannot do it. The trouble is that although the artist can do it, the price that he has to pay himself, and that you, the audience, must also pay, is the willingness to give up everything to realize that although you spent 27 years acquiring this house, this furniture, this position, although you spent 40 years raising this child, these children, nothing, none of it belongs to you. You can only have it. You can only have it by letting it go. You can only take if you are prepared to give. And giving is not an investment. It is not a day at the bargain counter. It is a total risk of everything, of you, of who you think you are, who you think you'd like to be, where you think you'd like to go, everything, and this forever.
Well, that was James Baldwin on The Artist. Let's see. Let's see. Got quite a few here in the archives. Let me see. What else? I think I'll play play this piece in game, AIDS in the Black Community interview with Dr. Lisa Fitzpatrick. That was really good. That was sort of a preview to this broadcast of this great film, Endgame, AIDS in the Black Community. And that was on Frontline, PBS. I was reading, Dr. Liza Fitzpatrick, about you actually in an article about Endgame, AIDS in the Black Community. You talk about why people are not getting tested for HIV, and you're a medical epidemiologist, and you specialize in treating HIV and AIDS, and you've done some recent research on the problem. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how you have made this a part of the testing aspect, a part of your general assessment.
Sure. Thank you for talking to me. This is a very important issue for me, particularly because I come into contact with people, unfortunately, when they're very late in their disease. And in 2012, we should not still see people who are diagnosed so late in disease, but we do, and this is why I wanted to understand better why people were coming into care so late in their disease. We're still seeing people diagnosed with end-stage AIDS, but then we get them on medication and they do fine. But it's much better for them if they're diagnosed earlier. Mm-hmm. So as I thought about how to look at this problem, I wanted to start with healthcare providers, because most of the people that we're finding late in disease have a healthcare provider. So my question was, well, why aren't they being diagnosed earlier? So what we tried to do was get a sense from healthcare providers by asking them directly, do you test for HIV routinely? If not, why not? And what are some of the reasons, or what are some of the barriers to testing people? And we found a variety of explanations, from some physicians and some nurses don't think their patients have HIV. Some are uncomfortable talking about HIV and talking about anything related to sex. We had some providers who were concerned that their patients may go to a different doctor once they were diagnosed and they would not see them anymore, so that would cut into their revenue. But we did have some providers who said they tried to do the routine screening, but the insurance companies were not reimbursing for the test and requiring them to fill out paperwork to justify why they were doing an HIV test. And I think in this day and age, we need some policies to address that, because that shouldn't be a barrier for providers to test for HIV. So there were quite a few things we learned from our activities around HIV screening for primary care providers.
Wow, that's amazing. The range of reasons why not test, why we don't test. That's interesting. So where did you conduct the study? Was it nationwide or was it in a particular region?
No, it was right here in Washington, D.C. I run the local performance site for an AIDS Education Training Center at Howard University.
Oh, okay.
And through this training site, our mission is to train healthcare providers around HIV. So we use the training center as a mechanism for us to seek additional funding to specifically study this topic, which is why healthcare providers do or don't integrate HIV screening into their routine practice. And we receive funding from Gilead Sciences, which is a pharmaceutical company, but they're also very interested in scaling up HIV screening across the country. And with the funds that we received from Gilead Sciences, we were able to conduct these additional activities to talk to healthcare providers about their practices.
So, Willie, you're definitely aware of the International HIV/AIDS Conference. Is it next month, August?
It's actually this month.
It's in
about 3 weeks. It starts officially on the 22nd.
Because a lot of the folks that are in the film Endgame
aides in the black community are going to actually be there. Jesse was telling me about how he's going to be flying into, I believe, Atlanta and then taking a train in, and there's going to be like a march on Washington, symbolic of the one with Dr. King looking at ending HIV and AIDS. I was wondering about the international HIV and AIDS conference and sort of how, you know, your work is, I guess, it has to do with our community, you know, the black community in particular, and not just the black community, but, you know, people not being tested. But this film is about, you know, why in Alameda County, for instance, there has been a state of emergency for HIV and AIDS for, gosh, about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's like, that's crazy that people are still, you know, there are still new diagnoses every day in our community. So it's really amazing. And then I think about HIV and AIDS abroad. I think about HIV and AIDS in Africa specifically, but not just there. I mean, people are still getting the disease, and these myths are still abounding. So I was wondering if you could talk about, are you going to be presenting at the conference? And sort of what are your hopes for, you know, being able to get together with your colleagues at an international forum? Because we haven't had the conference here in many, many years because of the rule or the stipulation that people that were HIV positive could not, they would not be granted visas to come into the United States, and that has actually been changed by our current President Obama.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will be presenting at a few different sessions at the conference, so I'm excited for the opportunity to talk about some of the work that we're doing here in Washington, D.C. around HIV and also community engagement around HIV, because I think that's what it's going to take for us to address this epidemic. We talk to patients about why they come late for a treatment, and a lot of it has to do with stigma, and I think people not wanting to talk about HIV in the community and a lot of the denial out in the community about HIV. We have to educate the community about this disease and that it's treatable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if people have AIDS anymore. So a lot of people are confused about the difference between HIV and AIDS. And we want people to know that it doesn't matter anymore if you have AIDS because the medications are excellent. So I can treat someone just as effectively who has AIDS as I could someone who has HIV. So I hope that some of these messages leave the conference and are filtered into the community. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the conference has limited access to the community, or community members have limited access to the conference. But I think moving forward, the march that you talked about, I think that is really important because it is an activity that happens in the community, whereby people in the community can take notice and maybe learn something about HIV. The conference is an important vehicle, I think, for networking, as you talked about, but I would like to see in the future how we could more effectively utilize so many of our resources to address some of the issues that are barriers to HIV prevention and engagement and care, such as stigma that I've already talked about.
Yes.
But also just helping people understand how you access care and treatment for HIV. And not just HIV, for chronic diseases in general.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I know a lot of times when there's poverty or, you know, the person is dual, triple diagnosed, there's, you know, there might be substance abuse, poverty, there might be some mental illness, depending on, you know, sometimes people are homeless and that sort of messes with you, you know, psychologically as well as physically and emotionally. And so the presenting symptoms are the ones that are identified first. Okay, we got to have a place to live. I mean, okay, I might be HIV positive or, but, you know, I'm also malnourished. And I know that that's not something that's unique to just the American community. It's also, you know, indicative of the way that chronic illness is handled internationally as well. If a person is homeless, then they need to get housed, and then they have a place to be able to, you know, cook their food, and because nutrition is important, and then go to the doctor. So I wonder if you could talk about accessibility of care, because at one point, I know in Alameda County, this is going way back, because I have a background in HIV AIDS prevention education, particularly around volunteer recruitment that's reflective of the communities where the disease was moving, which were people of color, so African American, mm-hmm. Latino, Asian, Pacific Islander, Native mm-hmm. American, and I think I got everybody. and so I was looking at recruiting volunteers to as a clearinghouse for the organizations that was their primary clientele, and we looked at things like that, but at that time in Alameda County, people actually had to go to San Francisco to access care because there was no AIDS office. The Alameda County wasn't necessarily looking at prevention of the disease, education, or services. Mm-hmm. Until some really wonderful activists like Gary Harmon, who is no longer with us, pressured the health department, the public health department, to address this in our community. So quality of life, affordable care, those kind of things. I was wondering if you could talk about that as well as prevention and prevention and education and what you're doing there at Howard. Yeah, some of the models, and I'm wondering, like, are they unique to Howard and Washington, D.C. area where you're working, or are some of them being replicated? Like, do you have, like, a cohort where you all talk as regions, about the work that you're doing?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of opportunity for us to improve our cooperation mm-hmm. and communication across the different programs and activities in Washington, D.C., We're fortunate in Washington, D.C. that access to medications for HIV is not a big barrier because the city provides the medications for people that don't have insurance. But because D.C. has engaged in Medicaid expansion, those people who didn't have insurance previous to the expansion are now being added to the Medicaid rosters, and so they have access to medication.
Well, we are not going to be able to finish that conversation with Lisa Fitzpatrick because we are joined in the studio by Director Ahmed Ashraf and the composer for his film, Jacob Yafi. Is that how you say it, Jacob?
Yes, it is.
Your films and the music, oh my goodness, it is a thriller, and it's such, wow, I mean, the ending is so unexpected. I see why you got all those awards.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow, it's so amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the music is so hot. I mean, so the variety of it is just so wonderful. I listened to a few pieces, and I was just noticing, sort of like, the mix of the genres is just really fantastic. So how did the two of you all meet to be able to pull this together? Was it because you're both in New York and both went to, was it New York University?
Basically, yeah. Actually, I got Jacob to work on my short, which is a whole different kind of more of a fantasy animation kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But then later when I started working on this, before I even completed it, actually, I knew that I wanted Jacob for it because he has that kind of the versatility of being able to mix kind of Wild West with Indian Bengali instruments.
Yeah. I just thought it was really amazing, Ahmed, that you grew up here, but you went back and forth to your home country, Bangladesh, often enough to have a dual type of citizenship. A lot of times, when one is raised away from one's homeland, where your family and your parents are from. Were your parents from there too, or was it grandparents?
Yeah, my parents are from there, yeah.
Yeah. And sort of how this film came about. So I should read your bio. I'll read the short one. Ahmed grew up in Philadelphia. There's a whole lot of great things happening in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. musically and politically. It's a real conscious raising kind of place. But he spent many of his summers in Bangladesh, where he draws a lot of his inspiration. And so, as we were already mentioned, he graduated from NYU, which is like one of the creme de la creme film schools. And he left the States.
And Price as well.
Really?
No,
scholarships, huh?
No, not at all. Jacob knows too, actually. Jacob also is from.
Yeah. Yeah, both of you. So you're making films to pay off your student loans, huh?
Basically. Yeah, we'll see how lifetime that takes.
I'll let you tell us about how the story came to you. But I just think it's just so wonderful, that whole idea of fatherhood and how one
mm-hmm.
really needs one's father in one's life.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacob, while I let Amit talk, I'll look for your bio so then I can introduce you properly. So, Amit, talk to us about, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Amit, yeah, that's fine.
Amit, okay, cool. Tell us about this story and about fathers and, you know, talk about your relationship with your dad.
Okay, yeah. I'm sure my dad will love hearing this. Yeah, no, the story came to me when I was in Bangladesh. I went to Bangladesh with several shorts, but they were written outside of Bangladesh, like in the U.S., out of context. So then I started talking with people there. I had a producer that I was working with, but then I talked with one of my grandma's maids, and she talked about how she has to do this work, this service work, because her husband left her back in the village. Her husband left her with three kids to feed, and he went off to the city or whatever, remarried. She doesn't know. So she didn't want him to come back necessarily, but she wanted some kind of closure, like somehow to find that person and bring him back. So that kind of is where this story came from. As inspiration, and then it grew into more of a fiction, you know, with this character who does find these runaways and brings them back to face their past. That character is fictional, but
mm-hmm.
the reason he does it is from real stories, I guess, I heard.
Yeah. So, Jacob, was this your first time in Bangladesh? I mean, were you there when the filming was happening to be able to get these ideas for the music?
Oh, I wish.
I
didn't get to be there. But, you know, Amit, I remember when we first talked, we were really concerned that, I was concerned, and I'm sure he was, because we talked about it, was... didn't want the music to sound like it was written by a white guy. I remember he mailed me. He's like, I'm going to mail you a few CDs from local musicians and traditional music ensembles in Bangladesh. And I got a box in the mail, and it had 35 CDs.
Wow.
And so I was like, you know, I really listened to it as much as I could, because the biggest thing they were worried about was, you know, especially Hollywood composers, if they're, you know, a movie is set in the Middle East or India or anywhere not in America, it's like you have this generic kind of ethnic sound that you
yeah,
can get musically.
Yeah, sitar and the drums or something.
Yeah, so we really wanted to avoid that. So
yeah.
I transcribed, actually, and I don't know if listeners know what that means, but I would actually listen to a lot of these CDs, and I would, by ear, I was writing down note for note what I was hearing, and then comparing that to, like, you know, Indian music recordings that I had and Middle Eastern, so that I could tell what the differences were.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, you know, Bangladesh really does have its own sound and own style, and I wanted to pay tribute to that. Luckily, you know, Amit's vision for this film was extremely unique, because he wanted to blend the Wild West or the Spaghetti Western sound of, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly,
mm-hmm.
with Bengali music, and he also wanted it just to sound like a, you know, have that, like, Hollywood film sound. So that was lucky for me, because it was kind of, you know, a blending of genres, and it kind of created this new sound, so that there wouldn't be right and wrong answers so much. It was just like, you know, is this
mm-hmm.
work for the
yeah.
film? know, is it really cool? And, you know, we have a lot of grungy guitars, and we did, like, I don't know, 1,000 recording sessions. It was really a lot of fun, and I think the end result is something that's
quite new and different.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, Jacob, which film for you is this, insofar as, you know, doing the score?
Let's see. I don't know what the number is now. I've done 14 features.
Oh, wow.
I think that Runaway must have been the 10th or the 9th or 10th in the mix. But, I mean, Runaway was working with Ahmed is a kind of a rare thing with directors. A lot of the directors I've worked with, they meet because they're, you know, the kind of the tail end of their project, and then, you know, you work with them really closely for 3 weeks and then you never hear from them again. But Ahmet and I, we worked and talked about Runaway before I even started. We talked for a year just about,
yeah,
you know, the sound of the film, and, you know, now...
Because originally
I just
wanted him for the short,
mm-hmm,
but then
yeah,
I was working on Runaway. I was like, here's this thing I'm working on. Why don't you take a look and start thinking about it from before. So it's good to have a relationship with your composer, pre-existing relationship, that you could just, like, call him up 3 in the morning and be like, oh, this piano, I'm thinking of this piano, listen to this piano. And he's like, go sleep.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, you have a jazz background, Jacob, and, you know, we already mentioned that you graduated from NYU, and that's where you met Ahmed, and you actually worked on his thesis film. So you all have you've already had a friendship and a working,
mm-hmm,
relationship. And I was wondering, you're in L.A. now, so you're in California, Southern California, and there's a lot of work for you, I'm sure, you know, in that area of the country and of the state. I was wondering if of the music that Ahmet, that you sent Jacob,
mm-hmm,
was, like, did any particular artist in particular sort of have an impact on you more than others, and, you know, like, were these, like, the top, you know, like, were any of them still being heard, like, as a top 10 on the radio or whatever?
Not so much, because the music that is being heard popular over there is more just, like, you know, rock music.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff I sent was maybe more of the traditional aspect, so Jacob can familiarize himself with the instruments of India. But what's playing over there in the radio is basically the same sounding as, you know, American rock kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some artists like Lalon is an artist who is who does a type of music called Bao music, which comes from it's very traditional kind of village, very minimalist, kind of just like simple music that's just really vocal. I think I sent some of those CDs to Jacob. He's like, Lalo is considered like the Shakespeare of music, kind of like this philosopher, you know, of music. He's more than music. But that's something, yeah, I did. I remember sending him.
I was wondering, could I play the title track, because it's really short, for our audience to hear a little bit, and then we can talk about those wonderful actors and actresses, particularly the children and all the people in the town. You have a big cast.
Yeah, I mean, that's one resource in Bangladesh that's pretty cheap, is people. So I made use of it.
And it's such a beautiful film.
Thanks.
It's really beautiful, and your cinematography is fantastic, and I'm just, like,
Kyle
sitting on my seat and, like, edge of my seat, and it's really wonderful, you know, for audiences that you are in town, and for the screening, your film Runaway is going to be screening at 7:15 at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, and you will be there in person. Unfortunately,
mm-hmm,
Jacob won't be there in person, but
no, Jacob will as well. He's up here with me.
Oh,
he's in the other room.
Both? Oh, because it didn't say that. Oh. Wow.
I think it was a last-minute decision, maybe, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. What a treat. It's always a treat when you know, the director and you know, the
team.
Other people, you know, within, you know, that are involved in the film making, you know, creation are present, and, you know, when cast is there, it's like, whoa, that's even more fantastic. So any of your cast in town?
No, cast, they're all in Bangladesh. That would be a little expensive for them to come over. But
well, yeah. After the student loans are paid off,
yes, yeah,
you'll be
think,
able to go.
But you know, they could always join us for radio. Always, you know.
Oh,
that's probably one thing they could join us for. I feel
okay.
like.
Oh,
you know,
that would have
so
been
something
nice.
In the future,
oh.
I'll think about. Yeah.
Next time.
Yeah,
next
totally.
Time.
Yeah, let's definitely.
Man,
do that.
They have a lot of things to say.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, that's totally good. Your cast is fantastic. So here's Runaway, and then we'll talk some more.
All right.
Ooh, Jacob. Wow.
Yeah, Jacob killed it.
Yes, he sure did. Yeah. So, are these like are these instruments or is this a computer?
No, those were all live. We had, you know, there were electric and acoustic guitars. You know, I have a really good guitar player friend that I was able to, you know, prep for this project too, and I said I really, really, really want to get like a grungier, more distorted version of the Clint Eastwood "Good, Bad, and the Ugly" Ennio Morricone sound. And we actually auditioned several guitars, and
nice.
I spent an entire week with him working on the sound. He did. He also actually throughout the film he improvised a lot for me on an instrument, and I said, you know, I want you to kind of do, I guess. More of, I gave him like a scale, and I said improvise using this, you know, kind of Indian scale, and Amit loved it. He was like, man, put that instrument everywhere, and it was a ukulele, and it ended up working.
Ukulele? Yes.
Yeah,
it was good.
It ended up working for the film really, really well. So we have all live instruments. That was live string, and dull drum and tablas, and then I had a drum set player. So. It was really a pleasure to record it and be able to. I mean, a lot of independent films you can't get that big, this one was really great because there were some, you know, honest action sequences, and then the ending was epic. So I was able to really pull out all the stops for that last little piece there, which is great.
Mm-hmm. So did you use any traditional instruments? Because I know there are some in that particular area of the world in South Asia.
Yeah,
oh,
that particular song didn't is more of the Wild West kind of, but the other ones, other examples, definitely have all kinds. Jacob, if you want to talk about, yeah.
Oh yeah, we recorded. We did several recording sessions with sitar, bansuri flutes, tablas, and dole drum. Mm-hmm. And the great, I actually, you know, contacted several Indian musicians in the L.A. area. Long before I did the recording sessions, and I went and heard them play, you know, just traditional music concerts, and I taught them about the project, and they even recommended, you know, music to listen to, and we discussed their instruments. I went over to the sitar player's house a couple times and just studied. I mean, I tried to study as much as I could, because when you're writing for an instrument, especially when you don't play yourself, you want to write stuff that's idiomatic and easily played and also sounds like the instrument. Because if you write, you know, if you're writing for guitar and you're writing music that's meant for piano, it's not going to sound right. So the same goes for the sitar. So on that track, we had the sitar doubling with the guitar to kind of get, and that gave it even more of a twang. But most of the score is got all of those instruments, the flute and the sitar and the tablas.
Listen to Abandoned and is it Bucho Ni Bai or something like that?
That's
one of the hip hop songs.
I know it. Nice. Yeah, what are they saying?
You know, the same stuff that we say, but in Bangla. It's like taking over the streets and stuff. Actually, I got to listen to those lyrics again. There's two of them, so I get them mixed up. But they're basically, one I actually commissioned him to do specific to certain themes that I told him about. So they're a little specific to the movie about kind of father issues, father running away, or family. The other one is just more of a kind of a hip-hop song.
Well, Amit actually did something really cool, just by contacting everyone early. And in the film, there's like one of the gangster back alley nightclub scenes. And, one of those, they go into the back room and they're, doing evil business and so forth. And so we thought, well, let's do like a really cool, we want to play some music in the club that's just dark. But we thought this would be an opportunity to do something really interesting. So I contacted a band in L.A. and they're kind of like a modern electric rock pop band along the lines of like M83. And they're called Future People. And I thought, I talked to Amit and we thought it would be super cool to do a collaboration. So we got a Bangla hip hop artist named Lamia, who did Bucho Ni Babai, the track you just mentioned. And we had the two of them, that band and Lamia, the Bangla hip hop artist, collaborate and create a song for the gangster club. So that one was, an original, I guess, hip-hop song created just for that scene, but it's a full song that we had created. And so there was, like, the L.A. band created all the, the musical part, and then the Bangla artist, he rapped on top of it, all in Bengali, which is I thought was a really cool thing.
Is that A Monster Is Born? Is that that one? Which one is that?
It's called Dorte. The list I gave you. I didn't give you the full soundtrack.
Oh, you did? Are you all, is that going to be available, the soundtrack?
It's on iTunes right now.
Oh, it's available?
It's on iTunes and Amazon and Rhapsody and everywhere online. It's on Spotify. People can check out for free. The song with the two songs that Lamia did are on the soundtrack as well. The collaborative song is called Dorde, D-O-U-R-D-E, and that one also, the band from L.A. is called Future People.
Okay.
So So it's all up there, and, check it out. There's lots to choose from, lots to hear from the film. There's about 18 or 19 tracks.
Cool. So tell us about your wonderful cast. They are fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Are so beautiful. Oh, my goodness.
Thanks. It was the same system, same process, casting, audition. But the plus thing is that they, a lot of them work in TV.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like really the main industry there. Like cinema isn't, feature films isn't really a career so much. So I could just watch their TV shows, buy the DVD, and then I could just see kind of something like that, which is pretty cool. But I auditioned them. They came in. I went through the whole process of several different choices. And I finally locked down on the main characters. And some of them like the henchman character named Raj, that was sort of a choice that I just saw him on Facebook. like my producers like told me about him. I just saw his picture on Facebook. Like, yep, that's the guy. That's who I want. He has the look and the kind of the attitude in the eyes, you know. Then I went and met him. He's not even an actor. He's really actually a director who did some acting in the past. But for the character of that was fine. He doesn't really say much. He's really more of a presence and an attitude. But the other character, the main character, Akbar, who has to be, that was tough because he has to be older and younger because we show him in the flashback too. So originally we went to some older actors that were more prominent, that would have probably added like, you know, face value and like people would know. But we went with this, Shaquille, who's, that's his name, he's pretty new. He hasn't done features before. He's done theater a lot. He's really a theater background. But he was young. He was at that age where I could make him older and younger. And he had to run around a lot. So we couldn't really get an older actor to do that so much. So that was great. He was, yeah, and they're all
with
like
a cinder
really,
block around his neck.
Yeah, but that's also art direction. So it's really a fake cinder block. But that's our great art director, Shahbuddin, who was nominated, by the way. The actors are all, I kind of purposely maybe chose actors that were fresh, kind of, like, they're hungry to do work, passionate, and they're really passionate about it, and that's really what made this happen, because it's like getting a feature done in Bangladesh is, I have a lot of director friends, too, back in Bangladesh, and they're having a tough time with their films, and they're already established and older, and they have, like, big money behind them. But it's even for them, it's hard. Because there's also, like, the ego thing comes into play sometimes with actors. And, like, me being such a young, new, almost outsider kind of to them, you know, I'm like an outsider, like, coming in. Sometimes it could be hard. Not that they're all professional, they wouldn't like step on you, but sometimes that dynamic of me telling them what to do, if they're already kind of a big time, big shot, it could be tough for me. So I kind of chose actors that I could kind of mold very easily, and not have a problem with that. And so I think it worked out pretty well.
Wow, yeah. So as a storyteller, because you've been telling stories since, gosh, a long time, and I think you've been making movies since you were 11, right? Professionally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the little camcorder too.
Yeah, and you know, you won all kind of competitions because you're such a great writer. So what, you know, with regards to this, you know, you had the story, and it was, you know, you were moved by this woman's story so much that you just sat down and it just came out. So being at home and actually filming this, sort of, did anything come up for you artistically that just like really just amazed you and shocked you and just really pleased you?
Yeah, all the time. Like, you know, when you get that right shot sometimes, you know, you don't picture every aspect in your head. You know, you have idea that it's going to be like this and like that. But when the camera opens and it's golden hour and the sun's coming just at the right time, you know, right before it's sunset, and it's just like, wow, I didn't even realize that, you know, like we could make these beautiful images, you know. So that's like pretty, when you get that, when you nail that right shot and it's like beautiful, everyone gets, that kind of like excites everybody. Everyone's like, yeah, we got that. That was cool. Yeah. But a lot of the times it's the opposite, whereas people are, you have to really get them kind of moving sometimes because it's long days. But yeah, I mean, throughout, there's sometimes you maybe as an artist or film director, I don't stop and smell flowers, you know, as they say. You don't get a chance to like really appreciate like the great, like everyone's talent and everyone coming together sometimes, until maybe you're screening it finally, then I'm like, yeah, finally it all came together, because you're always seeing it really up close, you know, and in pieces. But when Jacob sends me like awesome tracks, I'm like, yes, this is awesome. This is great. You know, this movie's going to be cool, I hope. You know, so it's like those little, sometimes there's those little moments you know, throughout, you know, even shooting or after, where you're like, yes. But for the most of the time, it's like, oh, what am I doing? It's not working. Everything's going to heck, you know.
So how's the film being received, you know, in Bangladesh? I know there are a lot of films in South Asia. South Asia is known, you know, for its great cinema. And I was wondering, sort of like, you know, has it been a box office hit? And your soundtrack,
well,
is it like blowing
yet.
Up all over the place, Jacob?
No,
what's going on?
It hasn't been released yet. It's going to be releasing in December.
Okay.
I just came back from Bangladesh right now, and I'm just preparing all the sensor. You have to put it through the sensor board. I showed it definitely to certain groups, you know, theater owners and distributors. And they liked it. They said it was a great film, but, you know, they're concerned whether how commercial this film could be, because it's not, you know, your typical song and dance kind of movie, and that's really what the audiences are used to. Or there's other kind of genres they are used to, but this is definitely a totally new kind of film for them. There's no, like, example to follow. Like, we don't know if it's going to be a big flop or a big hit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be coming down to the marketing of how we market it. That's going to be big. But we'll see. I mean, the people who've seen it, the Bengalis who've seen it, they really enjoy it because it is fresh for them. It's a different kind of movie. I think that we need that in our film industry, Bangladesh film industry, because it's a little stagnant in a lot of ways.
I just thinking about sort of like the storyline. So is it new because of the storyline, or is it
new in every
everything. Aspect?
I feel like I kind of went and I could have really like studied the film industry and what kind of films people like to watch and make, and that could have been smarter as a business sense, but I kind of went there and watched some movies, sure, and I watched Shrota Dutra movies from before, but I kind of just went and I was like, you know, I'm just going to not let that influence me and just make my own kind of movie that's set in Bangladesh with Bangla actors. They're speaking Bangla, but it's going to be a different kind of story, different kind of music, different kind of editing style, you know. They're not used to so much like intercutting, and I was influenced by Tarantino, City of God. So, you know, like kind of like going off, telling this kind of story right now, like telling this, branching off a little bit for a second, telling a flashback or whatever. It's definitely, you know, people who've seen more international movies might, and it has that Hollywood kind of like orchestral sounding, feel to it, and surround sound. So these are things that I don't think Bengali audiences are so used to. So I don't know what's going to happen there. It's exciting. It's pretty interesting to see what happens.
I was thinking about, you know, sort of being bicultural. Are there any filmmakers like yourself? You know, are you sort of forging new territory?
Definitely there is other directors who come from L.A. or the U.K.,
mm-hmm.
Who've either settled there or kind of going back and forth. And yes, they do. There are other directors. There have been other movies where they explore new territory. There has even been another Western kind of Bengali Western kind of movie also called The Last Thakur, who is the director's from the UK. So there have been kind of these bicultural mixture going on,
mm-hmm.
in Bangladesh. But, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, and I just love, you know, the scene on the beach. It's so beautiful, and the silhouette, that's just so gorgeous. Where is this? Where is that?
It's in Chittagong, which is in the south of Bangladesh.
Uh-huh.
It's near the shipyards. I think Chittagong, typically, if anyone does know it, will know it for the images of the ships being dismantled, these huge old ships that are broken down for the metal parts. And you can see in the back there's ships kind of that are docked in the sea.
Okay, yeah. And Is this where your family's from, in this area, or not?
No, my family is from the, basically from the capital, Dhaka.
Okay.
And they're from their villages, their ancestral, whatever, grounds are from all over Mana, but they pretty much settled in Dhaka.
Yeah. Well, you did send to me Dorday, so
okay.
I can play that. And I want to let our audience know that we've been speaking with Ahmed Ashraf, director, and Jacob Yaffe, composer, for the film Runaway. And how do you pronounce the other? How do you, what's it? What's the language?
Udhau is the Bangla name.
Okay. Yeah. Say it again.
But are you talking about the song? The song is called Dorte.
No. The other name for the movie.
Yeah, Udhau.
Udhau. And what's the language that you speak in?
Bangla.
Bangla. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the film is screening at 7:15 at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. And both of my guests are in San Francisco, and they're gonna be there. And you'll be able to ask them all the questions you want to ask, and say, when is it gonna be available on the DVD? And okay.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I should have brought some CD. I was going to bring some soundtrack CDs, but I didn't get a chance to print them out. But they are available
online. Yeah. And give the website again for your film.
The website is basically runawaythefilm.com, or our Facebook group is facebook.com/runawaythefilm.
Okay, great. Well, this has been such a fantastic interview, and your film is wonderful. So I'm sure there are other collaborations in the works, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm chatting up Jacob about this nonsense, other things. And then he'll find out why I'm really talking to him.
Yeah, you think you might do a feature animation film?
Oh, yeah, definitely, maybe, yeah. I mean, I love to do fantasy visual stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe a mixture of live action and animation, yeah.
That'd be super, yeah. And Jacob, do you have a website?
I do. It's jacobyaffemusic.com. My last name is spelled like coffee. So it's Y-O-F-F-E, jacobyaffemusic.com, yeah.
Okay.
And we've got runaway clips up there, yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, thank you both. It's been a really wonderful conversation. I'm going to play, pronounce it Dorte? Is that how you say it?
Dorte, yeah. Run.
Dorte. Okay, cool. Yeah. Super. All right. Peace and blessings. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Bye-bye.
Tu মা দেওয়া কষ্ট একদিন তোমার বুকে লাপটি মারবো সারা বসি দেখতে যাইবো সবাই লইয়া ঠাট্টা করবো তখন ঠিকই রাইখা আসা দিনের কথা মনে পড়বো
Runaway. And again, Ahmet Ashraf and composer Jacob Yofi is they're both gonna be in town this evening at the Roxy Theater as a part of the San Francisco International South Asian Film Festival, which is in San Francisco through the 23rd and in San Jose for one day only, the 30th of September. And I am going to play an archived interview with one of the curators of this wonderful film festival. I've been getting over to the Pacific Film Archive because I've just been having so much fun seeing these films called L.A. Rebellion, Creating a New Black Cinema. And last night, oh my goodness, well, Wednesday night I saw film by Larry Clark, who's actually at San Francisco State, As Above, So Below, and some short films, which are really good. Ben Caldwell's Medea and I, an African anthology, really, really nice. And then Don Amos's Ujamaa Uhuru Shilole Community Freedom School. Those were really, really wonderful shorts. And so that was Wednesday night. And then last night, Thursday, the 20th, I saw Jemaa Fanaka's Emma May. That was really good. It was set in Compton, which is kind of fun. And Emma May is a girl who, she's a cousin, just came up from the South, Mississippi, to stay with her older cousin and her cousin's family. And this talks about her adjustment. And that was preceded by Jemaa Fanaka's A Day in the Life of Willie Foster, Death on the Installment Plan, which is a great film, anti-drug film. It's really, really good. So that was really fun. And then next week, on Tuesday the 25th, I'm going to go back over to PFA to see Your Children Come Back to You and some short films, and that's by Alile Sharon Larkin, a woman filmmaker, and that film is about a single mother eking out a living from welfare check to welfare check, masterfully presents a child's perspective on wealth and social inequity. And then there are going to be some other shorts that explore family relationships. Rich by S. Torinano Berry, Shipley Street by Jacqueline Frazier, and Fragrance by Gay Abel Bay. And then on Thursday of next week, the 27th, Charles Burnett's My Brother's Wedding is going to be a screening, and that's going to just be all by itself. Actually, they're going to be a couple of shorts. Robert Wheaton's A Little Off Mark, so that should be nice. My Brother's Wedding is about making choices, and sometimes, you know, one makes the wrong choice and has irreversible consequences. So that I've really been enjoying that, and there are a lot of other things happening here in the Bay. Hamlet is opening at Cal Shakes this weekend, and then next week, Top Dog Underdog, Susan Laurie Park's piece is going to be opening at the Marin Theater Company in Mill Valley, and then the Cinemas 2012 San Francisco Latino Film Festival is continuing this weekend through the 28th, which is next week. And some other things are going on I'll tell you about a little later. So let me find that interview with Ms. Patricia before we run out of time, because we're sort of running out of time right now as I continue to speak and not look for that interview. Gosh, I was really excited. I thought for a minute that we might get our guest from the Hun Her Tu ensemble, but I think they're having some difficulties because I don't know if they're in motion or if they're here. But, yeah, I was really excited that, oh, we're going to be able to hear them after all. And been getting texts all this morning, but that didn't happen. And, gosh, I am not finding my interview. Oh, no. Oh, heck. Let's see. Gosh, I just passed by my Rochelle Farrell interview. That was heck of fun. And Renee Marie, that was a great interview, too. And Ruined at Berkeley Rep, that was a good interview. Maybe I'll just play that one since we're running out of time. So let's, Lynn Nottage's Ruined, really wonderful piece. I think I'll just play. Maybe I'll play another piece from the film. This piece is called Abandoned, which I really like.
Thank you. much racket. There must be something out of kilter. I think that 'twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. What's all this here talking about? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles, or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could help me. I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's this they call it?
Intellect.
That's it, honey. What's that got to do with women's rights or Negroes' rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yourn hold a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he says women can't have as much right as men. Cause Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. The first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone. These women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they just asking to do it. The men better let them. Obliged to you for hearing me. And now, old Sojourner ain't got nothing more to say.
That was Avery Sharp. Sojourner Truth, Ain't I a Woman? And I thought it would be a perfect song to introduce our panel of wonderful artists that are going to be talking about this great exhibit curated by Michael Ross, who is also a part of the exhibition, Race, Art Before Answers. It's at the African American Center of the San Francisco Public Library in association with Afro Solo Arts Festival 19. So I want to welcome Michael Ross. Good morning. How are you?
Hi, Wanda. I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Oh, I'm fine. It's so good to have you on again. We celebrated Marcus Garvey together, and now you're back again.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, with some of your artists that are in the exhibit, like Stephanie Johnson. Good morning, Stephanie. How are you?
Good morning, Michael, and good morning, Wanda. Thank you for this opportunity.
Great.
Hi,
good
Stephanie.
To have you. And Patricia, are you joining us for a minute?
Yeah, just for a really quick minute, and I'm sorry for the echo.
Right, yeah, we're going to have to let you talk fast. And let's see, I think Kemet, are you on? No? Well, you have to tell me who you are because I can't.
Oh, this is Ramakan.
Ramakan, oh my God. Oh, I just love your work. Oh, this is so wonderful. Cool, Ramakan, excellent. Thanks for joining us. And there's one
my
more person,
pleasure.
I believe. Is there anyone else that we didn't call your name? Nope. Okay, great. So, Michael, why don't we start with you, and then we'll shift right into Patricia because she's going to have to run. Tell us about the artist reception and conversation this Sunday at the San Francisco Main Library.
Yes, that will be this Sunday, as you said, this Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4, and that will be it will be going on the lower level downstairs, and we'll also very likely be going upstairs at some point to look at the exhibit, which is on the third floor. Yes. So
yeah.
That's 2 to 4 this Sunday afternoon, the 23rd.
2 to 4, right. And the library is located at 100 Larkin Street, and it's a free event. And Afro Solo is still moving on with a lot of great activities. So you can go to afrosolo.org for the entire schedule. So Patricia, tell us about your wonderful work, as a, working with textiles and this particular journey you take us through. What did you think about when you were interpreting the concept that, Michael, how did you present it to the artist?
Well, we wanted to talk about race, and since that has such a broad sweeping it's such a broad idea, I just wanted to know how everyone was interpreting it and how it's used in the work, and we pretty much went from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Patricia, tell us about your piece, because you're really well known, you're famous, like everyone on the air. I'm so happy you all could fit us into your schedule. I mean, not just in the San Francisco Bay Area, but you're world renowned because your work is just so wonderful. And Patricia, I am like such a fan.
I love your work.
Thank
you so very much. This is a mixed media story quilt, and it's a story quilt about all white neighborhoods in Illinois where no African-Americans could live. They could work there. As soon as the sun goes down, they have to leave. It was inspired by a book I read about all of these areas that were located, these suburb areas that were located in and around Illinois. And it was kind of fascinating because I was wondering if those areas to this day still exist. I know they had existed during Jim Crow and some of the other areas in our history, but I was very surprised to read about them still existing today. And so I created this quilt of telling the story about it and using some of the images and things that were used to deter African Americans for being in these towns after the sun went down were used within this quilt.
Yeah, it's really, really stunning, and one has to stay there sort of because the images, you have to sort of really sort of almost go into, sort of step into the actual fabric to be able to really see them. It's almost like they're ghosts.
Yeah, they're like kind of like ghost images, but in a lot of ways, even though they are very similar to ghost imagery, they also can represent just that whole hidden concept and that whole hidden thing that a lot of times we put aside and we don't want to talk about. And I think one of the things that mixed media story quotes and a lot of my story quotes do is it provides a way for people to start talking about an uncomfortable subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is race an uncomfortable subject for you?
Yes and no. It's one of those subjects that basically being an African-American female and living in this world, you're always up at, you know that people sometimes judge you mostly by your skin color before they judge you for your mind or for the abilities that you have. And throughout my life, I realized that I've always had to be better than native folks and be strong, you know, and doing the same job and all of those kinds of things. And you're aware of it. I think within our country, we don't talk about race. We keep saying we're not racist. And I think once America get a hold of that whole concept that we are racist, maybe we all start to heal and everyone will start to realize that people are people and it's not just the color of their skin.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to let you go on to work. Thank you so much for popping in and looking forward to seeing you on Sunday at the walkthrough and the artist conversation.
Oh, yes, I'll be there. And thank you so very much for having me again, Wanda. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh,
bye,
you're
bye.
Welcome. Bye, Patricia. See, Stephanie, when I was looking at your website, you were in your artist statement, you mentioned that all of your pieces are homages to the ancestors, that your work is an invitation to examine the delicate membrane which veils those who dwell in the spirit world from those we refer to as the living. And this membrane is called the heart, light. Historical artifacts, slides, and oral narration are your primary tools. Use these elements to reveal neglected members of our culture, replacing the re in parentheticals, them in public view. And I'm just thinking this particular piece is not in your usual tools. Mm-hmm. You usually work in light. And then you also mentioned a community in from the Yoruba tradition. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and also talk about your sculpture because, and why you chose that particular medium to tell this story about race, art before answers.
Well, wow. I could go on for about 3 days answering this question, but I'll make it brief and succinct. The image chose me. I had never worked in stone before, and I worked with the sculptor Amana Johnson, who's incredible. Her work is at the Oakland Zoo, and she's got a lot of public pieces. She's a stone carver. I took a class with her, and this was a huge piece of stone. And as I whittled away at it, I saw the shape of Africa. And I thought, no, I'm just tripping. There's no Africa there. And I just kept carving around and around. And that shape was there from the very beginning in the raw stone. So then I revealed the person that was holding the continent. And so, again, it was an expression, as you spoke to a minute ago with my artist statement, it was an expression of the ancestors working through me. And it revealed itself, and it revealed itself as a gift, something precious on the planet to give to the world. And this person, it's a woman, is holding it out, and you can almost feel it pulsing like a heart, you know, to give this gift to the world. And it's not my usual medium. I've only done 2 stone pieces. I'd like to get back to it, you know, at some point. But, yeah, generally I do work with light, which is very ethereal, and slide projections and lighting design. But this is very solid, you know, it's stone. So that's the genesis of that piece.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you did the lighting design for the Black Voices, the solo performances, a couple of weeks ago as a part of Afro Solo 19, Festival 19. And
yes.
That was another type of creativity. And those stories are all so different. Thematically,
yes.
Same theme as with this one. But,
yes.
You know, the interpretations were so different. So you had to, sort of adapt the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. One is solid and one is, you know, ethereal. and both of them are, you know, with both of them you can reveal metaphors and stories and narratives of Africans in the diaspora and of Africans and of our ancestors.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. And then we talk about spirit, light is such a great metaphor, isn't it?
Oh gosh, yes. You know, light reveals spirit, you know. I think it might be the manifestation of spirit on earth. One of the manifestations of spirit on earth.
Yeah.
Because of how it appears and disappears. But really without it we can't go on. You know, if there's no light, there's no life.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. So how did you come into this type of facility to manipulate this medium so well?
I went to school for theater. Mm-hmm. It is still my creative form of choice. It's the main one. I've been doing lighting design for 36 years. When I went to theater school, I took a lighting design course the next to the last semester. I fell in love with it, and when I graduated, I started doing lighting design back in Boston, and then since then, I've done it all over the world, so I kind of fell into lighting, fell in love with lighting, and stayed with it, and I use it in all of my work.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. Rami Khan, are you still with us? Uh-oh, I think we lost him. Oh, shoot. Yeah, I'd never spoken to him before. His work, I just really love his work. Ah, darn. Michael, are you still with us?
I'm still here, yes.
Oh, it's just me and you and Stephanie. Everyone's gone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
wow.
I didn't get a chance to talk to Rami Khan.
Maybe he'll call back, or Michael,
yeah.
If you have his number, maybe you can call him and get him back. I'm a big fan of his work as well.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, I'll call him while you talk.
Okay.
So tell us about, because I know you as well as an illustrator, and what you could talk about, that's really cool, because a lot of times people curate an exhibit, and sometimes their work is not actually a part of the exhibition, but in this case, you actually have a drawing. And so I was wondering if you could talk about that and sort of your whole notion of you know, this concept, race, art before answers. Does that mean that art, if art is before the answer, does the art give answers or just further the query?
Well, that's something that I was curious about. I was really inspired by a quote I read some time ago by James Baldwin. He had written an essay about creativity, the creative process. And if I can remember the quote, he said that the job of the artist is to expose the questions that the answer hides. And I was really struck by that because, you know, I had read before where he talked about the notion of we often think in terms of when we do something creative that it is, you know, presenting the answer to it. And I'd read before where Baldwin talked about that his creative work, his writing was asking questions. It was the process was questioning. And I felt it was appropriate because all of these artists, and many of them, as we talked about, as you've talked about, I'm also very big fans of the work of everyone in the show. And I was, you know, curious about how people express, because often we seem to do two kind of things about race, it feels like to me now, is either we don't talk about it at all, or when we talk about it, we seem to want some real specific recognizable references to it. You know, we only recognize certain things, you know, as race, and it seems to be a bit broader than that. Then sometimes people don't realize that lots of things are dealing with the concept of race, even if they may not look like it right away, you know, and that was kind of how this all came together with regards to that title, mm-hmm. Art Before Answers, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so. Yeah. And the particular piece that you included?
The piece I did is like like a lot of things I do, I sort of work in series, and this is from a series that so far has been about 5 pieces, and it's called Reading Self, mm-hmm. and it is combination of drawing and painting, and lots of my work is mostly like that, the drawing and painting. And it's figurative, it's more recognizable, and the series of pieces, all of them, they have male figures who are, you know, various dark colors, like they have various dark colors, and they are black male figures, and they are holding colorful books, open books. This one has a yellow book and the figure. And it comes from, I had started to notice in the past few years, I'd say the past 5 years, I keep hearing a theme from people that I knew, people who were black males often, and I may have done it myself. I did not think so, but I realized that we're all very similar. And I would keep hearing statements that were talking about what we tend to hear, all the statistical information we hear about black males. This percentage of black males dropped out of high school, this percentage is not literate, or this percentage is incarcerated. And I started to realize, and I would ask my friends or associates or myself when we would talk about that, what percentage of the black men that you know in your world reflect those statistics? Many times there was a huge discrepancy, you know, and so I was wondering, what is it like if we start with our own complete circle and work out and say, are there 80% of the black men that I know who are illiterate? Or if they're not, what does that mean? And I think that a lot of times we were thinking that we are the exceptions. And so I was wondering, if there's a lot of exceptions out there, we're starting to become sort of a big majority, you know? And so that was what my feeling was about the title of this piece, Reading Self, like reading into our own information before maybe reading all the statistical information, because, you know, those sometimes they are a problem, those statistics and how they are gathered and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right. And then you can also, and Stephanie, you could speak to this when we talk about getting a reading, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Michael, are you familiar with the African spiritual tradition of getting a reading?
Maybe you should tell me. I don't know if I know what you mean.
Stephanie, would you like to share what that means?
Sure. I think a number of different ways get readings. I have gotten readings from Louis Satish, from the Yoruba tradition. She throws the cowrie shells, and then she reads them in terms of what the ancestors or what the spirit will want you to do or pay attention to or be aware of or not to do. So, you know, there's other traditions. There's the I Ching, there's the Tarot. Sometimes people will read energy off body.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people will channel things. And so there's all different kinds of ways of getting information that you can't pick up in a book. It's kind of disembodied information that comes from another source.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, wonderful. Oh,
yeah. So, Michael, I called and I text Ramikon.
Ramikon?
Yeah, Ramikon. And maybe he had a time constraint that I wasn't aware of.
May have. He did say that he had some he could be for a little while. So that I didn't realize. So we weren't able to get him back.
Yeah. So maybe some other time, because the exhibit is up through October, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so we could probably get him again. and maybe get Marvin. But talk to us about, and you can chime in too, Stephanie, because you know some of these artists. Talk about some of the other work that's here. This is just a fantastic exhibition. It's like, oh my goodness, I mean, all the various genres and just sort of the various palettes that these artists, you know, choose to tell their particular story about the theme. It's just really, and about their lives, it's just really wonderful. It's really beautiful, really wonderful exhibition.
And I'll let Stephanie, if you want to talk about any, you can go first, please, Stephanie, or I'd be happy to talk about some.
why don't you go first as curator, because I haven't had enough time to spend with the exhibit.
Yes. Well, we have, as you said, Wanda, there are a total of 11 artists. I will go through, of course, there's Stephanie's work and Patricia Montgomery, who you just talked with, Ramakon O.R. Wisters, Marvin K. White, who we often know as a poet, but he does wonderful visual art as well, Derek Lassiter, who does photography, and Derek's also a singer, and Lisa Ramos, who does wonderful drawings. And we have Rodney Ewing, who does mostly printmaking, lots of wonderful sort of mixed media and printmaking work. Kemet Amanofis, many of us know Kemet, and he does various different types of work. His piece in the exhibit is from the NOK, N-O-K series, and cartoonist, I think we would say, Mr. Maury Turner, who is sort of a pioneering a person in the area of comics and cartoon. And we also have in the exhibit a piece from Candy Farlese, who does mixed media work. Yeah. Candy's piece is, it's sort of a cast of partial cast of a torso, and it has it is in a color that is sort of a beige or yellow color, and it's entitled Yellow Girl, and it has within it, embedded within it, several written phrases that seem to be things that one would be called as a woman of color who is very light skin, and it's also assumptions people make when they call. It's a really wonderful piece that sort of puts into fore what that is like. And Marvin K. White's piece is taken. It's sculpture, but it's taken objects. We would say found objects or repurposed objects. If you can imagine, it's two bathroom scales. It's bathroom scales, and they have the dial in them, you know, that has the numbers that tell the weight. And in inside the...
Maybe that's
Ramakon.
Yeah, it is
Ramakon.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so we're going to let Ramakon. Ramakon, you're back? Ramakon?
It's Lisa Ramos.
Oh, Lisa.
Lisa.
Yeah, are you with kids?
Good morning.
Good morning. Are you
Lisa.
With children?
Yes, I'm a teacher, but I'm walking away. They're having their morning snack.
Well, this is perfect timing, Lisa, because Stephanie Johnson is on the air, and of course, you know, Michael Ross, the curator, and he just introduced, you know, he just told us about all the artists, and he was going through sharing with us sort of the details of their pieces, and he was talking about Marvin K. White, whom people know as a poet and playwright. And so we'll come back to Marvin, and we'll just jump right into to your work. And yours is, I believe there are two paintings?
Yeah. No, I just have one illustration. It's a mixed media piece.
Okay. Yeah. So tell us about you know, your work, your piece, and your take on the theme, Race, Art Before Answers. Was this piece that you did... did you already have it in your repertoire, or did you create it specific for this exhibition?
I already had it in my collection. I've always been inspired by the beauty of black women. Mm. And one of my favorite characters is Carmen Jones, in Dorothy Dandridge film. So I was inspired by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And often I you know, in a lot of my work, I do figural illustration.
Mm-hmm.
And women are my favorite subject.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. So this piece is kind of reflective of that. And I think, too, what, when Michael approached me about it,
mm-hmm.
I think particularly for women, sisters tend to be, you know, our image and identity is filtered through media and our history. And it's kind of been embedded in our psyche, how we see ourselves
mm-hmm. yeah.
reflected through that and mainstream society. So I want us to see ourselves realistically. Like one of my favorite artists... contemporary artist is Micheline Thomas,
mm-hmm.
and her images of sisters are just extraordinary to me. You know,
yeah.
across the whole spectrum, light skin, dark skin, beautiful and very like naturalistic and earthy, but glamorous at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that dichotomy in her work. So she's an inspiration to me.
Mm-hmm. So I looked you up online, and if I have the right
mm-hmm.
person, are you from the South?
I am not. No, I grew up in the Bay Area, in San
okay.
Francisco and Berkeley. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So,
but I have roots in the South, from Alabama.
Oh, Alabama. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is it specifically about Dorothy? Well, not Dorothy Dandridge, but the character that you mentioned. What is it about her that draws you, and why did you, you know, choose her to represent, you know, this particular query, race, art before answers?
It was a vibration. You know, that part and that character, she's very powerful and very profane,
mm-hmm.
Very sexual, and... But, it, you know, even through that, there's, like, an exquisite beauty about her. You know, very dynamic energy she has. And even though in the narrative of the opera, Carmen, and in the film version, you know, it's destructive, but you can... What I like about the character so much is that the power that she exudes, she's unapologetic about who she is. Even though her karma gets, like, messed up,
mm-hmm.
I was always fascinated about that, about her. And then Dorothy particularly, I thought it was like her masterpiece. It was her best part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Dorothy Dandridge, that's a really sad story about this woman who is so talented and yet she, you know, couldn't find work because of the manipulation of the image in popular culture. And it wasn't feeling, you know, a black woman, you know, so.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was often at that time. The kind of, you know, her beauty and the beauty of black women in general was always oppressed and subdued in passive and direct ways.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And,
right.
You know, and my whole thing, like my work, I want us to celebrate it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And aggressively and openly. And again, unapologetically, this is who I am. And through reflection of ourselves. Another sister who is a big influence in my work and my approach is Audre Lorde.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
you know, because she's all about deprogramming ourselves, you know,
mm-hmm.
what our representation of is of our own beauty and our own identity and seeing ourselves through that filter.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is actually a new film about Audre Lorde, and I'll tell you where it's going to be screening. I think it's this coming week, actually, in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it because Audre Lorde, for our listeners, why don't you tell us a little bit more about Audre Lorde, Lisa and Stephanie, you can certainly chime in, and Michael, too, because she is just such a wonderful, was a wonderful poet and activist and writer.
She's a genius woman. So how did I discover her? I was in my 20s. And I read Sister Outsider, and it cracked my mind and heart open. I was like, that's it.
Mm.
You know, one of my favorite quotes by her is that black women are programmed to compete for male attention rather than look upon our common interests, our shared interests, what we have in common. We look more at what our differences are to compete for men. It's a very straight paradigm, you know, heterosexual straight paradigm. Mm-hmm. And it's part of, you know, patriarchal oppression, which exists in the community, you know, and that's part of our history, too. We often have been trained and programmed to be deferential to men. And she kind of set me on that path of being a black feminist.
She was really, really amazing.
What? Yes, Stephanie, do you have an Audre Lorde story?
I when I was living in Amsterdam, I met her.
You met her? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, she was there doing a workshop with women. She was incredibly dynamic, very out, very flirtatious, very strong.
Yes.
She came out at a time and in a place when it was forbidden and people had a lot of disregard for lesbians, you know, within the black community. And she was very much her own Afro-Caribbean self. She set a very, very high bar for ethics, for visibility, for strength. I mean, you know, wow, talk about can't touch that, you know.
she's a huge influence on me.
Wow.
I have another illustration that I did that was inspired by Isolde and Tristan and Isolde by Wagner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I like the whole narrative. Yeah. A mutual friend of mine and Michael's, Jason, he's a composer and an educator, and he had turned me on to that opera, and I did a beautiful illustration of her as black girl, of Isolde as a black girl. And a lot of times, what I'm kind of compelled to explore is these narratives, European narratives, classical, romantic periods, Renaissance, and reinterpreting them as black women, these heroines and these tragic characters and warriors. In addition to, like, you know, the traditional, like, African narratives and stuff, like Ngolonzinga and women like that. I'm going to be doing a mural of Ngolonzinga for a class at the school I teach at.
Oh, wow, nice. What school do you teach at?
I teach at Iliomade School in East Oakland. It's an African-centered school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to be coming over to Iliomade today. I didn't know you taught
there. No way! Oh, that's awesome. Bless. How beautiful is that?
Oh, wow. And you teach art there. That's too funny.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, that's too funny. I want to let you know that this film, a new documentary on Audre Lorde, is a part of the Berlin and Beyond Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the 17th annual, and it's all the films are screening at the Castro Theater, and it starts on September 28th and goes through the 4th, and this Audre Lorde film is screening on Wednesday, the 20th.
Mm-hmm.
No, it can't be screening on Wednesday because it's not started yet. But anyway, the Audre Lorde film is a part of that festival. And it's screening on the 29th. I'm sure if you can make it, you'll probably be in the house because, she's just a phenomenal woman. And what I love about her is her whole notion of biomythology. We don't have to get stuck in those stories. And Stephanie, I know you can relate to that because of your theater background. You know, we have these scripts, right? And we keep on trying out for the same roles. And it's like in life, and it's like, oh no, I don't want to do that anymore. And so you need to go. You know, you can either be your own playwright, which is the better thing, write your own script, or else stop trying out for the same roles because you're gonna get the same results.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And those narratives tend to be true, like, to, you know, the white mainstream. And I'm kind of over that. Like, films like The Help and there was another one I was doing with some young girls at the school. It's, you know, those narratives where they're telling us about us.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's marketable and I know it's profitable, but it's just absurd to me. I only watched that film because it was for my grandmother. She was a cleaning lady for 40 years and barely had a fifth grade education and used to pick cotton. And I really wanted to zero in and focus on the women's story. But then I was so struck by that film, it took a white woman for them to speak.
Yep.
I had a hard time with that. And I think that's one of the deprogramming things that Audrey taught me, like, speak up. Like, my thing is, no exists in my personal space.
Yep.
And we have our own voices and our own stories to tell. You know,
it didn't take a white woman for them to speak. It took a white woman for them to get to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Speaking, they've been passing their stories down to the grandchildren. We all have stories about our grandmothers, great grandmothers as domestic, but it took a white person, a white woman, and to write a book that then got published, that then became a movie. You know, and I'm with you, Lisa. I am over that. Which is exactly why I'm in a doctoral program right now, so that we can own our own histories.
You know, and when that film came out, I wanted to talk to my sisters about it and get their feedback, and I got the same opinion. Like, wait, it wasn't about us, it was about the white girl. And I was telling them about this film, Pariah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was an independent film by this sister, Dee Reese.
Yeah.
Studied under Spike Lee. No one knew about it. Why don't
we
know about
that? That's a beautiful film. That is the film. Poetry is so wonderful, isn't it?
Beautiful, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah,
wonderful
film. It's a really
great
film.
And why don't we know about movies like that? That's what I'm saying.
Yep. We're talking about.
And if I may say, I have to say, for my Audre Lorde experience, I did see that film, The Berlin Years, during the summer in the Frameline Festival, and I walked out really inspired. I was really, really inspired in a way that I haven't been in a long time. So it's really going to be worth seeing.
Well, this might be a new one, because they said it's a new film, so it might...
Well, it was just I think just finished or just about finished, and it was that, and then the filmmaker was there from Berlin, and she was talking about how it was just about finished. So it's probably, you know, sure it's the same one. But
you saw a preview. Okay.
It was in the film festival in the Frameline, the Gay Lynching Film Festival.
Oh, the one that is in the summer.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
cool.
So,
excellent.
And it was at the, I think, in the Mission, I think the Roxy, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful work. It's wonderful.
Okay.
Very inspiring. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. So, see, Lisa?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you have any other comments? I wanted to go back to Michael and let him finish doing his run through with the other artists, and then I wanted to ask Stephanie a question about Stephanie. You mentioned about the intra-racial conversations. So you can stay with us if you like, Lisa, in case you have some other comments you want to give.
Sure. I can stay for a minute.
Okay. All right. So Michael, can you start back with Marvin K. White, those scales, because he actually superimposed an image of his, it's sort of like a matriarch, an older black woman.
Yes. First, I want to say hi to Lisa. I didn't get a chance to say hi to Lisa.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Lisa.
I want to thank Michael, by the way. He's instrumental in me being involved in this whole project.
Sure. So,
very supportive. Thank you so much.
Sure. And so with Marvin's piece, we were talking about their bathroom scales, and the image, as you say, Wanda, that's superimposed in, he said that it's of his great-grandmother, and it is a group photo. It's a black-and-white photo that he has superimposed, and it's a group photo of his great-grandmother with about, I think it's three children, white children, that she cared for, and it's like one of these portraits that you see or photographs that you see with the black woman and the kids that she cared for. So it's not the kids' parents are not in the photo, but and not her children are in the photo, but it's her and the white children that she you know cared for. And I thought that was a really powerful. It's a really powerful object, and you see it. You sort of, and because it's a scale, you see in the dial. You sort of have to get you close to it to really see that part of it, and you start to see what's going on. And he titled it "The Weight of It All."
Yeah, I remember the title. I mean, without even looking at my notes, because I'm like, you go, Marvin.
Yes, yes. His way with words, the weight of it all.
Yeah,
yes,
yes. So poetic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. And hopefully you will be able to get Ramakan back. Another time. He's in the way that he does with a lot of things, again, repurposing objects, as he says, that kind of way. And it's called Our Fate Is Not in the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always intrigued by the things that he uses. It starts with a baseball. It's an actual baseball, and there are lots of feathers on it, and he could tell you more, but he's done many things with the notion of some of the African pieces that have feathers, that have nails, that have that sort of thing, that have the blades in them and the pieces that are used in that way. And so he has feathers. He has watermelon seeds strung together like beads, and they appear in that piece, and there's all kinds of things like that, and then it's sort of covered in this this sort of fur, kind of fake fur sort of thing, and it becomes this stunning, powerful figure. Yeah. So, and I think that those are some of the things that you will see, that people will see at the exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And where you got a chance to see Black Voices, didn't you, Michael?
Yes.
Solo Voices.
Yes, the piece you were speaking of with Stephanie doing the lighting and so forth.
Yeah.
Yes, it was incredible. Yes.
Yeah, wasn't it? They were just so beautiful.
Yeah,
I'm still like... Beebe's piece, and you know, and Javelin Richards' piece, and then Idris Cooper, Anifa Walsh's piece. I mean, they were just so like Southern Nigeria, looking at the oil, and then looking at the southern part of the United States and looking at the oil.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was really wonderful.
Yeah, and then moving, sort of into looking at our history and the ancestors, you know, and looking at that wonderful collaboration that Stephanie has, you know, ongoing with Javelin, and this is yet another one of Javelin's journeys and stories with that wonderful, you know, character who's like contemplating like freedom. Freedom.
Yeah.
What is, I got to go by the water.
Yeah.
And think about this freedom. And just hearing, you know, about, you know, her true love and what happened to him. That was so horrific. And she's telling the story to Sweet Baby, you know, one of her sweet babies, the only sweet baby that she still has.
Yeah.
And then, you know, moving into the diaspora and, you know, where, you know, white people are not commingling with black folks, and in Congo, you know, they have their place, and the black folks hang with each other, and then be stepping out of that environment and going, you know, abroad and saying, oh, wow, discrimination, racism, and that whole thing around the bananas, throwing bananas at black people, I'm like, whoa, I don't know that one.
Yeah, I don't. But, yeah, he did say that happens at soccer games and so forth sometimes.
Yeah, he did say that, yeah. And then this past week, I'm still, like, living in Joanna Haygood's Zaco Dance Company's Sailing Away, you know, the San Franciscans, of African descent in 1858, leaving this country for Canada because of the discrimination in the courts. You know, African people could not testify on their behalf, and this is predates the end of the slavery and the Civil War and all that. And I'm like, whoa. So, Stephanie, I say all that to say that you mentioned the intercultural dialogue.
Well, yeah, and just for the people that are listening to your show, that, you know, just as a kind of prelude, there was a discussion about how racism affects white people and how racism affects black people, and cross-racial discussions. And what I said was that at this point in my life, my project is not outside of the context of being a college professor and teaching, you know, white children, white young adults, children of European descent. Outside of that context, my project is not to illuminate or educate white people. My project is to work with people of African descent and other people of color to get that dialogue clear, to get it productive, and to get us working together. Because there's too much focus on what's going on with white people. And I really truly believe they need to work with each other. And it's very similar to ending sexism and any other kind of ism. In sexism, if men would step up and work with one another, we could move that project along a little more quickly rather than us having to tell them what they need to be doing. You know, they need to step up. So it's similar. Mm-hmm. And I just made clear where I'm at. Now, for some people, that's what they do. That's what they do, and that's a piece of the work. But I'm not interested in it right now. There's too much to do intraculturally with healing and communication ourselves.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and Lisa, you know, you're at an independent black school. I'm sure you
yes,
have
ma'am.
Something to comment on with regards to, you know, sort of healing our community and having and about these conversations around race and culture.
Well, it's a battlefield, you know. I mean, the way we've been shaped and what we've been through and how it's affected us and generations before us and how it's affecting this new generation. You know, things are in bad shape. And I think that the most powerful tool we have is our mind, our way of thinking, and how we approach the issue of race, how we navigate life in American society. I mean, these are crucial for our survival and for us to flourish.
Yeah.
You know, and be able to identify those traps and how to assess and analyze situations. You know, a lot of this, like the newer generation, they're disconnected from the past to some extent. You know, there's the gangster mythos is very powerful. Pop media images are very powerful. And they're filtering their identity through all of that. Whereas, like, the past is abstract to them largely. So, you know, I did an art project on Ethel Waters.
Oh, yes.
I also want to open them up to the world. You know, like our narrative is unique to this country, but there are other narratives in the diaspora. So I've done projects around Afro-Brazilian people, homework assignments in my Spanish class through like the Americas, Latin America, and native Spanish-speaking people. Pick a you know country with an African population. Tell me about their contribution to the culture and the cooking and things of, that come from Africa that have been incorporated into the culture. A lot of, they didn't know. They didn't know there were black people in Peru or in Colombia, you know. So you see how there's so much that's been edited out of us through the systemic oppression. And, you know, my whole thing is to, I've been at Ilhan Omadeh for 4 years, and my whole thing is get ourselves back. Get back to yourself.
Yep.
And filter ourselves, like our identity and who we are, where we come from, through our shared experience in history as black people. I don't want white people to tell me about it. I won't even read a white person's book about AIDS in Africa. I'm cool.
Yep.
I don't want to know. I don't, you know, that academic scholarly approach, like, oh, part black people. No, I want to know about Africans' experience in Africa, their history, their stories, their you know, issues, the political issues going on, their health issues, social issues. I want to hear about from the people. And when I get into a diverse situation where we have this dialogue about black beauty and the condition of folks in the U.S. and politics, there's always this weird discourse occurs where they become defensive. There's very few white people in my circle humble themselves down.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, even though they, you know, are progressive and liberal-minded, they get into this defensive, wait a minute, but I want to help. But you can't. They can't. They can't until we can help ourselves.
They can work with each other is what they can do.
They can work with each other. Write a check. You know, they have much more economic power than we do. Write a check. But the conversation and the work has to be done by black folks for themselves, for us, by us.
Yep.
In order for us to facilitate change and to flourish and live healthy, happy lives, not be shaped by all of this rigmarole that has been put upon us. And, you know, we deal with it every single day, every day.
Yep.
You know, Baldwin, James Baldwin, I had a lengthy conversation with Michael about many things, but James Baldwin particularly is another huge influence on me. You know, he said, you have to be conscious of being black 24/7.
Yep.
You can't, like, we cannot ever turn that switch off. Oh, it's cool. I can just walk in here and not even have to trip off it. You know, the first thing we do is look for someone who looks like us, you know, and assess if it's a safe situation or not. And then we have to navigate, you know, how people are coming at us and communicating with us. Are they trying to be down? Is there some disingenuous way they're trying to relate and not seeing our humanity before any, you know, or seeing our race before they see anything else? So, and, you know, and I tell my students that all the time, you know who you are. And Audre Lorde really profoundly set that seed in my mind. Know who I am and where I come from. And no one can take that from you. So that's the point of view I come from, and everything that I do in my work and in my art, I know who I am and where I come from.
Yeah. There's a lot of free music in San Francisco this weekend. I believe on Sunday there's going to be a performance with the Afro-Peruvian group out of New York, Los Planeros, De La 21.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's on Sunday. They're gonna. I think in Sunday in San Francisco is like a free day for museums, and they're gonna have concerts and all kinds of wonderful things happening. So that should be pretty nice. So people should look for that. And then tomorrow at UC Berkeley, they're having like an open day, or it's maybe the 23rd. Might be the same day for both. They're having they're gonna be having cultural performances throughout the campus all day, and it's gonna be free. I put that information on Wanda's pick so people can check that. Could you give us information one more time, Michael, about Sunday?
Yes, it's at artist reception is at the main library downtown San Francisco, 100 Larkin Street. It will be at 2 to 4 in the afternoon, and will be down on the lower level, certainly part of the time, most of the time, and then. For the end of the day, we should be able to go up, which is on the third floor, where the actual exhibition is in the African American Center, and that's at that's Sunday, the 23rd, 2 to 4 in the afternoon.
Super. Well, I look forward to seeing you all Sunday, and thank you both so much, Stephanie and Lisa and Michael, for sticking with us for the whole interview, and really thanks to Patricia for joining us, and thanks for Ramikhan. Am I doing the right?
Ramikhan.
Yeah, I just put an H there. Ramikhan. For calling in, and then to all the other artists that we're going to try to get for another time. But it's been really a great conversation. I really appreciate all of your time and for joining us in the studio, and look forward to seeing the exhibit again and to hearing your comments at length at the San Francisco Main Library. Are you going to be any particular place there for the talk?
We will be downstairs in the lower level in the Latino Hispanic room in the lower level, and there will be we'll be there. And
okay.
I should have said that's the name of the room downstairs in the lower level of the library.
Okay,
and that's where we will be.
Right, yeah, and they're having like a competing program in the Corrin Auditorium.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, that is so wrong. Same time.
Yeah, it's something to do with I think Obama's presidency, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
we'll be lots
sure
of people.
Know. Yeah. So maybe people can do both.
Yeah.
Do a little bit of that one and do a lot of yours.
Yes.
All right. You take good care.
And Wanda,
yes.
I wanted to thank you for all that you've been doing for so many, many, many years for the African and African diaspora community, all your events and your writings, everything.
Yes.
Stephanie, appreciate it. Yeah, I guess while we're putting in plugs, I want to remind people that the 17th annual Ma'afa commemoration ritual is coming up Sunday, October 7th. So you should check SF.com. maafabayarea.com for the information about that.
Okay.
Right.
All right. You take good care, and I look forward to seeing you, Lisa, in a little bit. I'm going to come over there.
All right. Thank you so much. I look forward to meeting you, sis. Thank you.
Thank you, Wanda.
Bye.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Right. Peace and blessings.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're going to close out with Ben Vereen singing Defying Gravity. Oh, and I want to let people know that this is the 55th annual Monterey Jazz Festival this weekend. Yes, there weren't enough things to do. And also the Harold Melvin's Blue Notes, they hit San Francisco with a bang, I'm sure, on Wednesday, and they continue through Sunday as well. At the Raz Room, and that's going to really be fun. I'm going to try to figure out, how can I get over there? And don't forget, Third Eye San Francisco International South Asian Film Festival is through the 23rd at the Roxy in San Francisco, and then it's going to be making a little brief cameo appearance on September 30th at Camera 12 in San Jose. So wonderful film festival. And we were so happy to have Amit Ashraf and Jacob Yaffe on the air to talk about Runaway, which is screening tonight at 7:15. And, gosh, I do not know where my details are on the Cal Performances open house, but I think it is this weekend. And so just visit wandaspicks.com for all the information. So we're going to close out again with Defying Gravity. Just love that song. It's just such an inspiration. You know, we can't let other people hold us down or hold us back.
Wicked. I went into the show with Shoshana Bean, and each night I'd hear Shoshana sing this song. I'd like to do it for you now. Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time I trust my instincts, close my eyes, and leave. It's time to try defying gravity. I think I'll try defying gravity. And you can't hold me down. I'm through accepting limits because someone said they're so. Some things I can never change, but till I try, I'll never know. So tired of being afraid of losing love. I thought I had lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high a cost. I'd rather buy defying gravity. Yes, I will try defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Unlimited, my future is unlimited, and I've just had a vision, almost like a prophecy. Oh, I know this may sound crazy, and it's true, the vision is hazy, but I swear someday I'll be up in the sky defying gravity. Yes, I can fly. I'll defy gravity, and you can't hold me down. Can't hold me down. No. So if you can find me, look to the western sky. As someone told me lately, everyone deserves a chance to fly. And if I'm flying solo, at least I'm flying free. To those who try to ground me, they command.
That was Ben Vereen, Defying Gravity from the Wicked soundtrack. And I want to mention one more thing, that self-respect and community self-defense is going to be a community symposium Saturday, September 22nd, 12 p.m. to 5 p.m.-ish. And Decolonizing the Imagination is the theme. And it's going to be at the Humanist Hall, which is 390 27th Street in Oakland. And it's going to be a conversation that I am going to be hosting or facilitating after the Mutual Aid Society band performs. And Marsha Tramiel was on our show last week talking with a couple of other wonderful, wonderful drummers, Donald Robinson and VJ Anderson. We had a great conversation. You should definitely go back in the archives and check that out. We were quite deep, or the brothers were quite deep, I should say. And also tomorrow at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, Farai Shadaya is going to be facilitating a conversation or a discussion with Judith Jameson. Yes, the Judith Jameson, artistic director for the Avenaley Dance Company. And now she has passed on the reins to another director. And so she's just, you know, sort of just basking in her wonderful brilliance and sharing it with us here in the Bay Area, because she's going to be in town. So that should be nice. I think that's 8 to 9 p.m. That's going to be really fabulous. And, yeah, the free family event in the San Francisco at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts is the 23rd. And I guess I really could check and see if the Cal Performances event is also on Sunday. I have a feeling that it is. Oh, yeah, it's called Free for All. And, you know, I meant to have someone on my radio show from Free for All, because it's just, they do it every year, and it's just so fantastic. Oh, it hasn't happened yet. Oh, so we can still have someone on the radio show. Okay, so it's actually Free for All is on the 30th, so maybe I get somebody on the air to talk about that next Friday. Oh, good, so we don't have to be all stressed and saying, oh, how are we going to do all of this, because it's just too much stuff happening. Oh, excellent. All righty. So let me take a deep breath. All right. So, yeah, well, that's awesome. So I'm really looking forward tonight to catching up with the wonderful musicians, Hoon Her Too, that we weren't able to have on the air this morning. You know, there's always these various difficulties when we're speaking in these languages, which are not necessarily our own. So there might have been, you know, some kind of communication snafu, because everyone is not necessarily fluent in this language, English, as we like to believe, those of us who sort of claim, I don't know, try to make other people conform to our paradigm. And that's something that the West does quite a lot, and we have to be careful that we don't participate in that type of I guess it's not chauvinism, that type of, you know, sort of bias or unequitable type of thinking. So what am I going to play now? Let's see. I am going to play another song, since I am still talking. And I think I will play Muhal, which is one of the pieces that our brother Khalil Shahid did with his Moroccan ensemble. So, yeah, so we're going to play Muhal from Tajin. Put together Morocco Project together. So, yeah. Yes, he is the Moroccan part, and Khalil is the African diaspora part. Well, it's all African diaspora. So anyway, we really miss Khalil, who made his transition. Ah, gosh, was it last year or was it this year? You know, I'm drawing a blank. It's just, yeah, I really miss the brother. Miss him a lot, but we know that he is with the Creator and with the ancestors, so he's ever present. So looking forward to having my audience tune in to another edition of Wanda's Picks on Wednesday, September 26th, which is a special day for me. And, 6 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. Peace and blessings.